Good morning. Seeing that we have a quorum, I would like to call to order the Subcommittee on Metropolitan Council Accountability and Transparency. And we're excited to have an opportunity to be involved in this subcommittee. We will be joined with the Government Ops Committee, so anything that would pass out of here will go to that committee. We are fortunate to have their nonpartisan research people with us, and the staff for that committee will be the staff for this committee, and we'll be following the GovOps committee rules as well. So wanted to thank the members that for agreeing to be on the subcommittee. I think, as far as I know, this is a first. I don't know that either Senate or House has actually formed a committee around the issues of the Met Council, but certainly within the last year there's been a lot of ink spilled and a lot of blogs and tweets, radio, talk radio issues and so on that have surrounded the Met Council and their activities and their programs, and certainly probably more activity as a result of the Thrive 2040 plan. Which I think put a lot of people sort of on a higher interest level. So our plan for the committee is to proceed with a few weeks of hearings. We'd like to gain a better understanding. If you really are following the Met Council, you've got a number of committees. Otherwise, you have to be aware of, and their funding sources are multiple, and so on and so forth. So. This hopefully will bring together the opportunity to really understand them in more depth. So we'll do some hearings, and we'll notify folks about those as they come. And at some point, we'll take up some bills. There's certainly some bipartisan interest. We're very happy to know that there's a shared interest at the local level about the growing power of the Met Council, and that people are talking about that and wanting to get a little better handle on it. So there will be some bills. We haven't really, moved in that direction very much yet. But anyway, the plan for today is that we are going to start with a big broad picture and get some history on the council. How did it come to be in its present form, and what were the legislative changes along the way? That might get us into some topics that we'll want to hear more about. So we'll sort of follow what the questions become, but knowing that we won't be able to get much depth in those questions, but those could be potentially reasons for another hearing in the future. So let's see. I think that what we'll want to do is just go around and have the committee introduce ourselves and just what committee, local governments you represent, and what your interest level is in this topic. You hear things from your own experience or local officials that indicate maybe there is some need for reform. So if you would share that with us, that would be great. And I'll start with our vice chair, Representative Jim Nash.
Madam Chair, thank you. My name is Jim Nash. I serve District 47A, which is Western Carver County. In my previous elected capacity, I was a mayor of the city of Waconia, and I have heard from a great number of local elected officials of both parties that there is a need for reform in the Met Council, that the things that they control oftentimes put municipalities and counties in a difficult position to execute their jobs. And I think that some reform is warranted, and I'm glad that we've got a bipartisan group of people here to look at that with scrutiny to understand how we can really better enable local municipalities and counties to do the job that they were elected to do not get in their way. So, thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Representative Tony Albright. I serve the middle third of Scott County, which comprises Prior Lake, Jordan, and the townships of Credit River, Spring Lake, St. Lawrence, and Sand Creek, which extends it basically from just the boundary almost of 35W over to Highway 169. And as a representative of Scott County, as has been evidenced by recent conversations by the county board with the Met Council, we too share our concerns, such as Representative Nash has expressed, the encroachment, if you will, that the Met Council has made on behalf of their interests. And we believe that there certainly is a need for a Met Council, but going back to the charter itself and try to define what that purpose was in light of recent expansions of the Met Council in terms of moving into other areas, that certainly on behalf of the commission, commissioners of Scott County, is contradicting their intentions for growth on a local level. So thank you for my participation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Yvonne Seltzer, and I represent Southern Minnetonka and Northern Eden Prairie, so I have two governments, and I am new to the GovOps committee, and I'm excited to be on this subcommittee. What I've heard so far as I've broached this topic with the locally elected officials in my area is that they certainly do appreciate the good work that's been done by the Met Council, but all of them are happy to meet and that we're in the process of meeting because they all have ideas on how things could be improved.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Carolyn Lane. I represent Columbia Heights, St. Anthony, and New Brighton. We, in the last month or two, had a discussion in the area of the northern suburbs, and it included this area, so it perked my interest. I again would see some possible reform, but I do appreciate much of what Met Council does do.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jim Geldman. I'll be serving as DFL Caucus Research to this subcommittee.
Thanks. To introduce yourselves, too.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Matt Burris with House Research.
I'm Deb Dyson from House Research.
Yep. I'm Abby Loesch, and I am GOP Caucus Research.
Good morning. I'm Lori Halverson, and I represent the city of Egan, the eastern half of Egan, in District 51B, which is in Dakota County, and looking forward to having a really robust conversation about this topic. I am frequently in contact with my local elected officials, and I got to serve in the capacity on the Parks and Recs Commission in my city before I was elected, so look forward to the conversation.
Hi, I'm Kelly Fenton, and I represent Woodbury, House District 53B. It is 100% of my district is Woodbury, 70% of the city, and I also fall within Washington County, which is one of the members that that Met Council represents. So I'm happy to be a part of this. I do, you know, I'm in constant contact with my local elected officials at the county level as well as at the city level, and I think there's some good ideas, and I think it's great that we're having this conversation when talking about reform.
Amanda Tinsley, Committee Administrator.
Very good. Well, why don't we then proceed? We're going to go through a history of the council, and I think that questions, as they come up, I think we can interject the questions, and then we'll just kind of keep current. So thanks, and do proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Again, my name is Deb Dyson. I'm from the House Research Department, and I'm going to begin the presentation with some background on the region and the council. Just to give you a current overview of the region itself right now, the Metropolitan Council's jurisdiction is in the seven metropolitan counties of Anoka, Carver, Dakota, Hennepin, Ramsey, Scott, and Washington, with the exception of certain cities that are named in statute that have grown from outside of the seven-county metropolitan area and have grown into it. So it excludes the portions of Northfield and Dakota County that have grown into that county, Hanover and Rockford and Hennepin and New Prague in Scott County. The estimated 2013 population for the region is about 2.9 million. The state's total population is 5.4 million. So at this point in time, over half of the state's population is in the seven-county metropolitan area. The seven-county metropolitan area includes 142 cities, 42 towns, and other special districts like watershed districts and similar. In terms of governance, the Metropolitan Council has always been unique in the country in terms of being a limited-purpose political subdivision of the state. For those who follow regional planning and governance, there are a number of areas of the country that have what are called Council of Governments, which are voluntary associations of local governments. At this point, I'm not positive on who's organized that way, but in the past, Denver, for example, had a Council of Governments. But the Met Council is not a regional government that's been formed by mergers of cities and counties. In the past, you had Miami and Dade County that merged, Indianapolis and Marion County that merged, and there's some other areas of the country where that has been the form of forming a regional government for the metropolitan area. And then finally, the Met Council is not an elected home rule charter regional government as Portland is. Although there have been, as I'll mention, a number of times when the elected council has been a proposal and actually was actually enacted by the legislature once, it was vetoed. Going to the governance of the council, it was created in law in 1967. At that time, the statute provided for 15 members of the council. It was created as a political subdivision with this, and at this point, there are 16 members from districts and a chair that's appointed from the region at large. From 1967 to 1994, all the members served staggered terms. In 1994, that was changed so that they serve at the pleasure of the governor.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Dyson?
Yeah.
I apologize. I'm going to just pause and ask you for clarification or definitions, because I think that's maybe some of the rationale for this first. Could you describe what a political subdivision is and what its function is as it relates to itself and other political or governmental entities?
Ms. Dyson.
Madam Chair and Representative Albright, political subdivision is probably the broadest term for anything that's not the state that is a governmental entity. In any particular statute, it might be further defined to mean city, county, town, or you know, any other combination. So when I'm using it in this context, I'm citing it because that's exactly what the statute says about the Metropolitan Council, that it is a political subdivision of the state. So it's not the state, but it's clearly not a general purpose unit of government because it's not a city or a town, but it is a political subdivision. So it's governmental.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To follow on with that, Ms. Dyson, then, as a political subdivision, the inference is that it is the arm or the proxy for another entity. Would that be true?
Ms. Dyson?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I'm not sure what you mean by that. Can you explain a little more?
Madam Chair, Ms. Dyson, political subdivision in the context of on whose behalf do they do their work.
Ms. Dyson.
Madam Chair and Representative Albright, a political subdivision's work is on behalf of the residents of the region that, or the unit of government that is defined. So, for example, with the Metropolitan Council, it's got jurisdiction in the seven counties with the exceptions of those cities. And their work is as defined by the legislature. So,
is that right?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm trying to get at the root, and maybe I'll ask a following question. It was created by the legislature in 1967 at the behest of whom?
Ms. Dyson?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, actually, if we go to the next slide, we can start this chronology going. In 1967, The Metropolitan Council, well, prior to the Metropolitan Council, there was a planning commission that had been established in the 50s, and I can't remember if it was called the Twin Cities Planning Commission, but it had a fairly weak set of powers. So in 1967, as the region was growing, one of the big issues that the cities were facing, and every time somebody gives a presentation about the Metropolitan Council, you'll hear another set of anecdotes about what was driving the decision to create a regional body such as the Met Council. The one that always has stuck in my mind had to do with wastewater. And at the time, there was, as the region was growing, you had a lot of different wastewater treatment systems or lack thereof. And, for example, Minneapolis had its water intake valve in the Mississippi River, and somebody was proposing wastewater treatment plant that would be dumping effluent just upstream from a water supply intake. And so there was a decision or a growing discussion in the public, among local governments, among legislators, probably many residents, that there was a need for some broader level regional planning and coordination in order to ensure that things like water and wastewater and transportation were looked at on a regional scale, and that one community's water supply wasn't going to be threatened by somebody else's effluent, for example. When you say who's driving it, I think as an elected official, you know that what drives elected officials comes from your constituents. And it was the same for the local elected officials at that time as well as the legislators, that there was a broad consensus that resulted in legislation. Now, it was not broad in terms of what was proposed, because in the 1967 legislative proposals, there were two very different competing proposals. One was to create an elected body, and it would have had different powers and duties. So the governance structure was tied to what powers and duties would be given to that body. So you had the elected council proposal that would have included the planning and operations, but would have been an operating agency as well as planning and coordination. The proposal that ultimately was enacted was more focused on long-range planning for the region, but did not have specific operating duties for any of the systems. And part of that had the appointed body, and that's the one that ultimately passed. And if I recall reading about this from before, that elected proposal failed very narrowly, one or two votes, and much as it did again in 1994. But so you have that division of what are the powers and duties and what governance structure goes with that. And what resulted in 67 was an appointed body, 15 members from districts, which at that time were specifically tied to the legislative districts. A number of years later, in the early 70s, it was changed to be districts more like what we know now based on redistricting of the region. But originally enacted, it was just pairings of or combinations of legislative districts. And then the duty to figure out what to do with wastewater, transportation, I think there were some other major regional facilities. I think one of their original duties was to figure out, you know, what should we have a zoo? There were a number of major regional amenities, functions, and services that they were looking at. And then as you get to, as you'll see on the slide there, in 1967, in a separate law, the Metropolitan Transit Commission was established, and that was to take over a bankrupt private transit system and provide transit services in the metropolitan area. Another one of their duties was regional parks and open space planning. As the area was developing, people were seeing a need to preserve parks and open space for the region before, as development was taking place, so that the people in the cities would have access to regional parks. And that was one of their duties.
Ms. Albright, what should we just let her proceed, and some of this will be...
Yeah, I just want to maybe just have a clarification, Madam Chair, in terms of Ms. Dyson. You spoke about, in a sense, kind of their original duties that were, you know, may or may not have been enumerated in their original charter. And so my question goes to the point you've identified wastewater treatment and the coordination of efforts on that across, you know, municipalities. You've also mentioned parks, possibly a zoo, but immediately following your mention of wastewater, you mentioned transportation. And I'm just wondering if you meant transportation of water or if you meant transportation, and if so, in what context did you or have you understood the original charter to mean and denote what transportation meant at the time?
Ms. Tyson, and I think and then following that question and answer, let's go on and pick up the rest of it if we could.
Madam Chair and Representative Albright, what I would prefer to do then to try and recall that the enacting legislation, what I will do is get a copy of that to you from 1967, and you can look at the original law.
Appreciate it.
And
very much.
Just understanding that pretty much every year there have been changes by the legislature to the enabling legislation for the council.
Thank you.
Ms. Dyson, please proceed.
Okay. One of the proposals in addressing the issue of wastewater treatment for the region, the council proposed establishing the what became the Metropolitan Waste Control Commission. It was originally called the Sewer Board. And it was established as an agency of the council, subordinate to the council. The council appointed the members of the Waste Control Commission. There were seven of them originally on the board. In 1974, you have the Parks and Open Space Commission Act, again establishing the Parks and Open Space Commission as an agency of the council with eight members paired, which are made up of the paired districts of the Met Council, and that still is there today. The it's an advisory body to the Metropolitan Council to look at the Parks and Open Space plans for the region, and we're talking about the regional parks, not local city parks, not the pocket parks and things that are very local. We're talking about the regional systems for trails and parks, and that the commission still is there today and is still advisory to the council on establishing the policy for and the plans for regional parks. At one point in 1974, there was also a charge by the legislature to the council to look at solid waste. Since that time, the solid waste duties have been moved exclusively to the counties and to the PCA. Anyway, I'm not as familiar with that part because it hasn't been part of the council's duties for a long time, but at one point it was. At another point in time, the council was the Area Agency on Aging, and that was spun off as a nonprofit at some point in the early 90s. So at different times, it's had different duties assigned to it by the legislature that then have been changed and moved on. So it is a living entity that the legislature has changed from time to time in terms of its powers and duties. In 1974, there was probably the first major restructuring of the council, where it was changed to 17 members. This is where it changed to being from being based on legislative districts to its own districts subject to redistricting. And at this time, the Metropolitan Transit Commission was put under the Metropolitan Council. Its membership was eight members from the and the MTC members were then appointed by the council. So it was made an agency subordinate to the council. In 1984, another big change came with the creation of the Regional Transit Board. And this shows a trend all along with the both the legislature looking at how are things working with this regional agency and how can the legislature help make things work better and trying out different models. For 10 years from 84 to 94, there was the Regional Transit Board, again subordinate to the Metropolitan Council. The council appointed its membership, and then it appointed the Transit Commission. So you had a three-level process going, because there was an attempt to make have the council focus more on the long-range planning and big picture for the region in terms of transportation issues. The Regional Transit Board was established to look at the mid-range planning, implementation, the capital budgets, be the financing coordination body where they would make the grants to the providers and to figure out how they interacted with each other. Then in 1986, there were some other changes to the council's planning functions, trying to, again, have focusing more on the long-range planning of the council for the various systems and requiring capital budgets. It wasn't a governance change. It was more powers and duties changed with related to the metropolitan policy planning. In 1989, the Metropolitan Airport Planning Act, the Met Council was part of that in reviewing plans. That's what it was called, the dual-track airport planning process. It was that was concluded in 1995 or 6. Anyway, it was concluded with expansion of the existing airport, but the Met Council had a major role in that as well in looking at reuse of the existing airport site if one was moved to a new site. So they've had been assigned specific roles at different times in looking at regional infrastructure. In 1992, there were a lot of proposals being made for restructuring the Metropolitan Council. And a lot of it was driven by issues related to transportation, but also comprehensive planning by local governments and the council's role in reviewing those plans. In 1993, probably 6 different bills were introduced, everything from turning the council into an elected body to establishing the council with its own as a legislative body with and separating the legislative functions from the administrative functions of the council. But what really brought things to a head was the Regional Transit Board had established a new provider for Metro Mobility, and the system didn't work. And you've probably heard the stories before, but when the new system came online, it didn't function well enough, and Metro Mobility riders were stranded on the streets and were not picked up for appointments. And the governor at the time called the National Guard to operate Metro Mobility. And it was kind of a big deal. So with that, the legislature established the State Advisory Council on Metropolitan Governance to meet over the interim to figure out what to do with metropolitan government. There were legislators on the task force, then Representatives Myron Orfield, State Senator Carol Flynn were the co-chairs of that advisory council. It had public members on it appointed by the governor, including for one of the former chairs of the council, and it worked very hard through that interim to review proposals from all the local government associations and state agencies and citizens on what kind of governance structure would work. The ultimate proposal that came out of the advisory council was to abolish the Regional Transit Board, abolish the Waste Control Commission, and there was one other that got abolished, MTC, and move all of the operating functions into the Metropolitan Council so that the council became an operating as well as planning agency. The proposal at that time was also to make it an elected body. That came to the floor in the House first, and it was a long debate, and it failed by one vote. And it came back 3 days later with the appointed governance structure, but instead of having staggered terms, it came back at that time with all members of the council appointed and serving at the pleasure of the governor, which has been how it's been since then.
So Ms. Dyson, then I was actually there at the time, but I don't know remember all of this detail. But how had the members been appointed prior to the governor appointing them?
Madam Chair, the governor has always made the appointments to the council. It's just that they were appointed to terms. And the thinking behind staggered fixed terms instead of serving at the pleasure of the governor, is that for a planning body to have any kind of independence to carry over from one administration to another, to have that long-term view, you had to have members who weren't necessarily all replaced all at once with the election of a new governor. And the choice in 94 to go with serving at the pleasure of the governor, in my view, was in part driven by the fact that the Metro Mobility collapse, that somebody was to be accountable. And that those were always the questions. Who should be accountable for the actions of the council? And it's a legislatively created body, appointments by the governor, but there was a feeling that people didn't know who to go to and say, you're accountable, and how to be efficient, equitable. So that governance structure at the time, and you know, at that point in the session, you're very close to the end of session, and the discussions are happening in the hallway, and I don't know all the discussions that go on, but that was my understanding, is that providing for going from, if it wasn't going to be an elected body, going from staggered fixed terms for council members to serving at the pleasure of the governor, that there was an intent to try and make the governor's office and the governor ultimately responsible for regional government.
Okay, that offers a lot of clarity for sure about why it is the way it is. Representative Dash?
Madam Chair, thank you. Ms. Dyson, before we get too far afield, you mentioned that the Met Council districts are subject to redistricting. Can you kind of give us an idea? Is that coterminous with the decennial census redistricting as well, or how does that work, and how does it get deployed, and how does it get ratified?
Madam Chair, and Representative Nash, yes, it's in statute, and it is with the federal decennial census, and the redistricting is to be completed in the year ending in 3. So, and it's after the legislative districts have been drawn. The redistricting is done by the legislature, and it's enacted in law.
Representative Nash?
Madam Chair, thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right, Ms. Nash, so, Ms. Dyson, please proceed.
I think the next major thing I wanted to talk about was the Metropolitan Livable Communities Act, and actually I'm going to go into more detail about that in a little bit when we talk through some of the budget items, but the Livable Communities Act was in 1995 and created the accounts for the tax-based revitalization. It was a brownfields cleanup funding mechanism using property taxes and a grant mechanism. It's the Livable Communities Demonstration Account and the Local Housing Incentives Account. And the main thing to keep in mind with this program is that it is voluntary participation, although I know that there are local governments who feel like almost like it's mandatory because they want access to the money that's in the tax-based revitalization account and the other one, but it was set up that if you participate in the housing, setting housing goals and for life cycle affordable housing in your communities, if you're participating in the local housing incentives account, you are now eligible to participate in the other funding mechanisms for your community.
So, Ms. Dyson,
will have more data on that from the council's budget in a little bit.
I wonder if we could just touch a bit on some of the revenue sources. And so Livable Communities Act, does that come with money? And really don't hear much about it these days, but is that a revenue stream then for the council?
Madam Chair, that's Ms. property Dyson? Taxes.
Ms. Dyson, if you would talk a little bit then. Did the council always have the authority to levy the property tax then?
Madam Chair, in 1995, the original, and I'm going to be kind of fuzzy on this because I didn't look into this. I didn't refresh all my recollection on this, but the original Livable Communities funding for at least one of the accounts, there is a general property tax levy for the Met Council. They're supposed to take, I think, $1 million from that and put it into the Livable Communities Fund. So there's $1 million every year that's property tax that just is shifted over from their general levy into it. Then the I'm going to get into weeds I shouldn't here. The the original one actually took money from the Mosquito Control District's levy authority, reduced their authority for levying, and gave that authority to livable communities. A year later, the mosquitoes went back up to their levy authority, so they weren't really affected. There was some shifting around of levy authority to make it more revenue or property tax neutral originally, but it shifted. But it is in statute, and I actually don't have the details on the levying authority at this point.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Dyson, through the chronology that we're going down through, I just have a question. I'm familiar with the fact that the funding or the budget that is the Met Council's purview is roughly 90-10 in terms of federal versus state contributions, and you can correct me if I'm not wrong, but my question goes to the point of, at what point in the chronology of the Met Council's existence did federal funds actually become part of an ongoing source of funding for the Met Council?
Ms. Dyson?
Madam Chair and Representative Albright, I can't really speak to the transportation fund. The Met Council has been the MPO, the Metropolitan Planning Organization, since the early 70s. And to the extent the Met Council, in that Metropolitan Planning Organization role in allocating transportation, federal transportation funds, it goes back to that. The for housing, it also goes back to 74, because the in 1974, the Metropolitan Council wears a second hat as the Metro HRA and is the pass-through agency for Section 8 vouchers for suburban communities that ask the Met Council to be their HRA administrator. Other federal money... I'm not sure if I'm answering your question.
Representative Albright?
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the point in terms of maybe circling back to the question in terms of it is readily apparent that we've added responsibilities to the Metropolitan Commission almost on a every year basis, it would seem. And I'm just wondering if they were used as kind of the agent of courier for federal dollars that would be incented to, you know, look at some of these programs, and the Met Council was actually utilized to capture those as programs from the federal government were rolled out in terms of to facilitate those on behalf of the government or as a pass through, as you say, for HRA and that type of thing. Is there any documentation to identify as you added, or as the state has added responsibilities to Met Council, that it was done in coordination with federal programs that were also looking for a home to be facilitated through, and Met Council was the best avenue for that to happen?
Ms. Dyson, and then we'll try to get back to the presentation.
I'm not really sure how to answer that question. I guess I'd have to...
Maybe we can talk offline on
that. Yep. Maybe we can talk about
that. Representative, I think we're beginning to build a list of things that we want to learn more about. So please proceed, Ms. Dyson.
I should be keeping notes, and I haven't been. I want to wrap this part up fairly quickly. The Land Planning Act, there were modifications. The original one was in 1976 that made land use planning, comprehensive planning in the metropolitan area mandatory. In the rest of the state, it is not mandatory, but probably encouraged. But in 1995, the Land Planning Act was amended to require updates for local governments to review their local plans and figure out if there need to be updates at least every 10 years. And it's tied to the Metropolitan System Plan. The Metropolitan Systems Plans, the Met Council, Met Council does its review of the systems for the region, the transportation, the wastewater, and the parks and open space systems, and lets local governments know what are the likely changes and try and the coordination between them. And part of that review process is to protect the public's investment in the regional infrastructure by coordinating both the local and the regional infrastructure plans together. Let's see, 2001, the legislature established the Legislative Commission on Metropolitan Government. It met in December. It's advisory. The and the last thing I wanted to mention in terms of history is the 2001, probably one of the biggest changes for transit funding was the 2001 changes that shifted the transit operating costs off of the state contribution off of the general fund to, or off of the property tax, off of local property taxes onto the state using MDUST.
So, Ms. Dyson, initially then that transfer happened statutorily, is that correct? And then, what, in 2006 we did the constitutional amendment that made it more permanent, made it official? Ms. Dyson?
Madam Chair, I would defer to my colleague.
Mr. Burris?
Madam Chair, the change in 2001 was under statute, and I'll touch a little bit later on the motor vehicle sales tax constitutional amendment that was adopted by the voters in 2006, and that set up a constitutional framework, but the subsequent to that there were some statutory changes that actually implemented the constitutional requirements that had been put into place. Mm-hmm. So there was a phase in, and the legislature, after the amendment was passed, determined what the split of the allocation of the dollars.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Dyson?
The next thing, sort of looking at the council today, we have, in terms of functions, two broad areas. There's the planning and coordination function, relating to the regional systems, transportation, parks and open space, wastewater collection and treatment, and then there's local comprehensive planning coordination. The when I talk about the wastewater collection and treatment, just want to make clear that we're talking about the regional wastewater treatment plants that are owned by the council and the interceptor systems. The interceptors, so we're not talking about each city's local collection system, because on anybody's bill, utility bill, you'll see a billing for wastewater and water, but it's only a portion of that is the Met Council's charge because it's the wholesale provider of wastewater treatment.
So, Ms. Dyson, when it comes to then replacement or let's say just ownership, the Met Council owns the big stuff and the very costly pieces to that, and they're responsible through some of their funding if there's replacement or repair, maintenance, that kind of thing. And then the cities have the whatever is closer to their neighborhood.
That's correct, Madam Chair. The and the wastewater treatment system is user financing, mm-hmm. both okay. for its debt service and operations.
Right. Thank you.
What drives the planning and coordination is statute that directs the council to adopt the Metropolitan Development Guide. I think it's now being called the Thrive 2040. Anyway, it each time a new one is developed, it gets a new name, but it's the Metropolitan Development Guide required in statute 473-145, and that has been part of the law for a long time. And then the other part that drives it is the Metropolitan Land Planning Act for that planning and coordination function. When you get to operations, my colleague, Mr. Burris, will talk about the transit and transportation issues. The council has made presentations before, but I'll highlight the numbers that are used to describe the scope of this system, the wastewater treatment system. You've got the 2.7 million people, 108 communities. It's about 95% of the region's population is served by the 8 treatment plants, 60 pumping stations, 610 miles of interceptors from 5,000 miles of local sewers, and treating about 250 million gallons of wastewater a day. The council also works with more than 800 industrial clients. in terms of the Housing and Redevelopment Authority. The Metro HRA is one of 11 in the region, but has the largest Section 8 Housing Choice Voucher Program with about 6,200 low-income households served in Anoka, Carver, and most of suburban Hennepin and Ramsey counties.
Ms. Dyson?
Yeah.
Just going back to the wastewater system, we keep hearing that the Met Council described as unique amongst major cities in the country. I mean, what part of it is unique? Would it be this total regional approach to wastewater collection, or just what is the uniqueness aspect? I mean, it came to, I mean, I just thought it had to be the wastewater thing, but maybe that's done everywhere. And I know that Mr. Shetnan is here too, if he has interest in chiming in anytime. All right.
Madam Chair, I guess when I'm thinking of the uniqueness, it has more to do with the fact that it's a governing body established in law with governed by a body appointed by the governor for a region. As that, okay. It's primarily the governance structure, its powers and duties. Other regions have, I don't know if there's another region that has the exact same set of powers and duties. Mm-hmm. I guess when I'm talking about it, I'm thinking of how it's governed.
Okay, great. Not the services. All right, thank you.
Could be the services as well, Madam Chair, but
all right.
That's not what I was referring
mm-hmm.
to.
Mm-hmm. Let's
proceed. Under the pass-through funding function that the council has, the right-of-way acquisition loan fund, this has been around since 1982, and essentially MnDOT can't purchase highway right-of-way until a road is actually programmed for construction. This revolving loan program is funded through a property tax, and it's estimated to be about $3.3 million a year. What I noticed in this year's budget is that they didn't need a levy for it. It's based on projected needs for making loans to the revolving loan fund. So if there are loans that are being repaid and they expect to make them out again, they may not need to levy. It makes the loans are to buy undeveloped property located within an officially mapped metro area highway where the right-of-way is threatened by development. So it preserves that land for the highway development and ultimately makes it more affordable to do the work. Another pass-through funding function of the council relates to the regional park system. From 1974 to 2014, this year's budget book says that $626 million, not the budget book, one of their publications online, says that $626 million in grants from the state general obligation bonds, regional bonds issued by the Council, the Environmental Trust Fund, and legacy money have been made to local governments. And it's for the different sources of funding goes towards acquisition by the local units of government for regional parklands and for operation and maintenance of the parks. The parks themselves and the open space areas are owned by the implementing agencies that are defined in statute, and that they constitute Anoka, Washington, Ramsey, Scott, Carver, Dakota counties, the City of St. Paul, the City of Bloomington, the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board, and the Three Rivers Park District. So the council's not an owner of the parklands. It has the policy plan and then does the pass-through funding to the local governments for the parks. And then the Metropolitan Livable Communities Act, which we talked about a little bit earlier. The slide has a lot of tiny print. but on the Met Council's website, there's an overall description of total funding since 1996 through the end of 2013 for each of the accounts. And I don't know if I think you have the PowerPoint handout, and I think you know you can read that, or I can, in the interest of time, we can.
Yeah, that would be fine.
Let that go, but the. There is a fact sheet on the program on the council's website that provides the same information.
Ms. Dyson, do you know if we're able to track then cities where the dollars are being used? I would suspect we could.
Madam Chair, I'm sure that we can get the information from the council. I did between the time I knew I was doing this presentation and now, I didn't have an opportunity to go in and try and find out how it is, but it does talk about the number of cities for each of these different programs. You, for example, the pollution cleanup grants, you're talking about 45 different cities under the livable communities, 67 different cities, local housing incentives, 51 cities. So it's been spread around the region. And in any one year, it is good to look at the distribution of over time, because in any one year it might feel like there's concentration in one area than another, but over time it may give a different picture. And I actually don't know. But I'm sure that that's something that could be developed.
We'll follow up with that and learn more.
Going to budget history. This is just to give you a big picture view of the funding sources and uses over time. Under this slide, you have the money that's going towards general administrative costs at the Met Council, community development, and as you can see, there's property tax, some state money, very little state money, federal funds, and then other is typically investment earnings or things like that. If you go to the next slide, the pass-through grants, you'll see a similar changes over time. The one thing I would just I looked up this morning because it struck me as odd. If you in the pass-through grants and loans, there really hasn't been a change in the pass-through grants and loans between, for example, 2009 and 2011. It's just that that big jump in state funding has more to do with how the suburban transit providers funding was classified. And it's now classified in their budget books as pass-through funding, whereas before it wasn't. So that's the change there. And, Madam Chair, with that, I think the only other thing I wanted to mention, even though it's at the very last slide, but there's a handout. You had asked for information on staffing trends. And the Met Council's budget, 2015 budget, in Appendix C, lays out the staffing trends from 2011 to present, the last 5 years, and previous budget books go back further. So I thought I would just give you a copy of this to look at, and as opposed to talking about it. And then the remainder of the presentation is that we have prepared this morning has to do with transportation, and Mr. Burris was planning on talking about that.
Madam Chair?
Mr.
Could we entertain a couple questions?
Yes.
Thank you. Ms. Dyson, I want to just go back to your slide about the occurrence of the property tax levy elimination. And that occurred in 2001. Was that concurrent with the legislation that created the Hiawatha Light Rail Line?
Ms. Dyson.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, in 2001, what I was talking about was very specific to transit operations being shifted off of property taxes to MVEST. I don't know of any of it being driven by Hiawatha at all. It had more to do with there has always been a lot of talk of how to make transportation transit funding stable, and there was a desire to get it off of property taxes, and this was the solution at the time. And it was primarily something that was happening, I have to admit, in the tax committee. And so I only have a limited background on what happened. So,
Representative Albright, any follow-up?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Dyson, on slide 10, and this goes to an earlier question I posed to you in terms of the utilization of the Met Council. If you'll note in each one of the bullet points, there seems to be a common thread that's woven throughout each one of those four by the use of the words leverage, will leverage, to leverage, have leveraged, to leverage. I'm just wondering, I have a subset question after that, but I'm just wondering if that is to account for federal dollars that were offered as an inducement to participate in certain transportation or livable community activities, or was this an invitation on the state's behalf to go looking for money that the federal government might have to avail us of larger projects?
Ms. Dyson.
Madam Chair and Representative Albright, I don't know about any federal money involved in this. These bullet points are copied from the Met Council's online publication explaining the program. I think a lot of it is leveraging private funds, private development. When you're talking about tax-based revitalization, cleanup of polluted lands, that's making land suitable for private development in many cases. So, but I think that is best answered by the Metropolitan Council as a follow-up question in terms of what was leveraged, because I actually don't have a specific answer for that.
Madam Chair.
Representative Nash.
In the telepathic matter that we seem to be having here, Mr. Shutton has said that yes, it is to use to leverage private grants.
Oh, okay. Trying to get my and city funds. I have to work on my peripheral vision.
Very good. Was there any follow-up then? Or
thank you, Madam Chair. Then to the point of if it is private dollars, what type of a stake do those dollars have in those projects, or is it a function of a charitable contribution, or what type of form does that contribution take on in terms of control? Or
I wonder, Representative Albright, if we should, I mean, it's a big topic, land use and all the strings attached and so on. It might be worthy of.
We'll add it to the list.
Add it to the list, I think. Yep, thanks. Okay. The budget piece, though, Ms. Dyson, I'm curious about, does Met Council capture any administrative costs then through some of these federal and state grants? I mean, does that become another source of funding? Do we know that?
Madam Chair, I assume that, for example, for the HRA, there's federal money involved in the administration of the Section 8 programs. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how to answer that because, the Met Council has administrative costs, and the budget books refer to allocation from different divisions for general administration. So
I think, Ms. Dyson, we'll do is, I mean, there's quite a section, I think, of budget-type questions, and I think we'll just schedule that for another meeting as well.
Yeah, and I think in terms of getting into those details, it might be about the current budgets and how they handle stuff. I think it'd be best to have the council be able, because they're going to be more flexible in answering questions that aren't anticipated.
Yep, got it. Okay, well, let's move on to then to Mr. Burris and Transit Finance.
Madam Chair and members, again, Matt Burris with House Research, and I'll be covering the transit side of the Met Council's functions. As I'm sure you're aware, that's a large share of their budget, as well as their staffing and operating transit services, doing transit-related planning. And I'll be speaking mostly on a little bit of background and then on some of the history and current breakdown on funding around transit and uses of the funds. Looking at the history, similar to the other areas for transportation, on slide 13, there's a brief breakdown on the types of the sources of funding, and we'll get a little bit farther into detail looking at 2015, and you can see that there's a state jump in the dollar amount there, as well as some a jump in the other category, and we'll touch on that. But this is just to give you a sense of the transportation funding over time. Really, I'll start by touching on a couple of background concepts. We had touched on the motor vehicle sales tax, or MVEST, a little while earlier, This is a sales tax that's applied to the sale of motor vehicles. It's applied in lieu of the general state sales tax and is currently allocated to transportation purposes. It had been over time allocated in some portions and in a somewhat on-again, off-again manner to transportation historically since inception of the sales tax. And at times it was fully put into the general fund, and at other times a portion went to transportation. And in 2006, a constitutional amendment was adopted by the voters that established a full dedication to transportation. And the constitutional amendment had a phase-in period that lasted from 2008 until 2012, 2012 being the first year of the complete phase-in. There are a couple of limitations that are in place under the constitutional language that essentially establishes a ceiling for highways and a floor for transit. Effectively, it's the same requirement expressed in two different ways, that the amount that can be provided from motor vehicle sales tax revenue to highways can't exceed 60% of the revenues, and the minimum for transit has to be at least 40%. So that's the constitutional framework that was established following the amendment being adopted. The actual allocation of funds is determined by the legislature through statute, and the legislature contemplated a couple of different allocation options in 2007 and ultimately enacted this 60-36-4 split. If you've heard of the 60-36-4, it's one of the various numerous percentage formulas that float around in transportation. This one is the motor vehicle sales tax allocation. So 36% is what is provided to the Metropolitan Council for transit operations and planning in this metropolitan area. In fiscal year 2015, based on the latest forecast, the total MVEST is about a little under $700 million. So that translates to about $251 million to the metropolitan area.
Mr. Burris, how does that fluctuate, or how has that fluctuated in the last couple of years through the recession? And do you have any idea what it might produce in 2016?
Madam Chair, it's been a pretty highly variable revenue stream overall, and has, I'm not sure to how tightly, but it has mapped to some extent at least to where the economy is at the time. So MVEST revenues were down against forecasted projections for a number of years during the recession. I can get you the number on the 2016 estimate. Right now, the forecast has it estimated as increasing over the next couple of years. But I could pull that out if you want to give me a second.
I take your word for it, Mr. Burris. You can. I'm sure we'll catch up to that number.
Actually, I'll be getting to a little bit on the history of MVEST from a certain point of view in a subsequent slide as well. Another background piece that isn't the Met Council but ties into transit funding and broader governance questions around transportation and transit planning and development relates to the county's Transit Improvement Board. This is another, I almost hesitate to say political subdivision, but it's a joint powers board of county elected officials. The legislation authorizing establishment of this board, or CTIB as it's referred to, was part of a 2008 transportation finance package that had a number of changes in it, and this was one component of a broader set of finance and some policy items. The authorizing legislation that's in statute provides for any of the seven counties in the seven-county metropolitan area to join the board, and currently of those seven, five counties are members. Scott and Carver sort of on the board in an ex officio capacity. And the essence of the board is to impose a sales tax and use that funding for transit. The sales tax that's authorized is 0.25%. So it's a local option sales tax on top of the other sales taxes that are in place in the metropolitan area and in regions of the metro area. For calendar year 15, the latest estimate I've heard is about $115 million. I believe that's CTIP's latest rounded number. The legislation lays out a number of requirements, so I'll just touch on a couple. One of the key ones is that the revenue from this sales tax is dedicated to transit ways, as well as park and rides, and that can be both capital and operating. And transit way as a concept is not defined in the statute and has been somewhat of a subject of differing views and discussion and debate among the various units of government, CTIB and the Met Council in particular.
Mr. Burris, the park and rides, are development of those is solely a decision of CTIB, or does MnDOT get involved at all?
Madam Chair, park and rides is an allowable funding use by CTIB, but the development of them is really under the purview of the Met Council / MnDOT. A lot of the transportation project process is kind of split. There are multiple pots of dollars and to some extent shared and to some extent differing decision-making authority kind of shared between the Met Council and MnDOT. And I'm not actually familiar with the details around park and rides. So with respect to CTIB, that's just one of the uses of funds that CTIB can put the dollars towards.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So the bulk of the revenues from the sales tax are allocated out through a grant application and grant making process to local units of government. There's a committee that's also established in statute to do this evaluation of applications, and that includes county elected officials, so the CTIB board members, as well as some city elected officials. Another component of the authorizing legislation is bonding, and the CTIB did bond in 2010 for capital purposes. Another area of the...
Mr. Burris, excuse me. So when CTIB issues bonds, is that under the umbrella of then Met Council or one of their counties?
Well, the legislation authorizes CTIB as a joint powers board to issue bonds and go into debt, and the backing is the sales mm-hmm. tax revenue.
Mm-hmm.
The legislation also authorizes agreements with the counties to issue debt on behalf of the board, and that's the path that CTIB ultimately chose. The board was pretty new at the time of seeking to issue bonds, so the rationale that I've heard expressed is by utilizing Hennepin County as the bond issuer instead, that they could get a better rate because the bond purchasers, I don't know that that's the right term, but I'll call them the bond purchasers, had more comfort with the Hennepin County backing of those bonds.
Mm-hmm. All right, thank you.
Then, Madam Chair and members, funding restrictions are another area of the legislation around CTIB. And two things are worth highlighting with that. One is that the projects funded by CTIB need to have some consistency with the planning process that the Metropolitan Council goes through. And a second item is that at a couple of points, which we'll see in a subsequent slide, the legislature has made some statutory requirements directing a portion of the sales tax funds to go towards transit operations. So in general, the CTIB has had decision-making authority around what transit ways to develop and fund the operations for, and the legislature has directed funds in a couple of scenarios to go towards bus operations. But in general, this funding stream has been for transit ways, and that kind of brings us a little bit into what that means. In the policies around funding that CTIP has developed, they're primarily looking at larger capital type projects, so LRTs, light rail transit, commuter rail, and some forms of bus rapid transit that involve dedicated right-of-way or shared right-of-way on highways, as well as associated larger stations. And that's a distinction from a couple of types of service that CTIP is not currently funding. And one of those is arterial bus rapid transit. That's a type of transit service that's somewhat like a commuter rail or light rail line, in the sense of having a distinct branding and a couple of amenity components that are something more than the regular route bus service. For instance, the waiting areas might not be a full enclosed station, or probably wouldn't be with arterial BRT, but could have some additional signage about when the next bus is coming. Generally, arterial BRT operates on arterial streets, so it's kind of local point-to-point service. It's not an express run. But there are some technological components that allowed for the service to run a bit faster than typical regular route bus service. There are a few other components, but that's kind of a sense of the distinction, hopefully. And then another area that CTIP has not been funding is, other than the legislatively directed funds, is regular route bus service.
Mr. Burris, excuse me. The highway BRT, an example would be on 35W South from the downtown?
Madam Chair, yes, that's correct. There, I forget which color corresponds to which line, but there's a line running on 35W, and there's Cedar Avenue as well as another bus rapid transit, and that's more of a highway BRT type model.
Mr. Burris, we phoned a friend, and it's orange. But was CTIP funding involved in that, and is that a shared cost with MnDOT then, in that instance?
Madam Chair, I'll have to double check. I believe CTIP did provide some funds for the orange line.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Yeah, we'd appreciate understanding that. Thank you.
Another policy worth noting with CTIP's funding is for the transit ways that the board funds. They're committing to fund 50% of the net operating. Net meaning half of the operating after the passenger fares portion.
Mr. Burris, just one other little question on express buses. Is that a different category, or is that, I mean, on to itself, or is that part of bus operations as it affects CTIP funding?
Madam Chair, bus operations would include express bus from the standpoint of CTIP's funding. So, in other words, they don't fund express bus, with a couple of exceptions. I didn't get into the minimum guarantee county component of CTIP's funding, but one of the legislative requirements was around certain counties being required to receive some portion of funds in their within that county, or funds going to within that county, and it was designed, arguably, it can be viewed as having been designed as a enticement to bring in counties where there's not as much transit line development anticipated immediately. And so somewhat under that context, CTIP has funded some express bus type work, I believe. And I can get you more detail around that. along with the orange line.
And Mr. Burris, you had a term for that? It was a what?
A minimum guarantee county.
There we go. Okay. Thanks. And Mr. Burris, those counties would be which, do you think? Do you know?
Madam Chair, I believe Washington County was one at the I think that's the only one currently. Yeah. Because there are a couple, you know, there are two counties that haven't joined the board.
Right.
Yeah, so it's just Washington County.
All right, thank you.
One other background area to touch on are property taxes as they relate to transportation in the metro area. The council imposes a property tax levy, and it really there are multiple parts that kind of can be viewed as separate levies. And one is the regional transit capital levy, and this is imposed in what's commonly referred to as the transit taxing district, or the regional transit capital levy area. Actually, transit taxing district is the terminology of the statute, and that is a portion of the seven county area, but it's not the entire seven county area. It is laid out in statute with authority for the geographic area to expand, and largely reflects the area in which the council is providing bus service. The revenue from this levy goes towards the capital side of the bus operation. So it's largely bus facilities, bus fleet. And looking at the latest couple of Met Council budget documents, the amount of the levy is for the most part used as debt service on bonds. Those bonds are issued by the Met Council under legislative authority and are used towards these capital procurements.
Mr. Burris, is that tax expressed as a number? Percent or whatever.
Madam Chair, we'll have to look that up. If I remember correctly, it's a percentage levy basis amount.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what I was thinking. A component of this is that the legislative authorization for the debt service on bonds, the legislative authorization to issue bonds for the Met Council is put into statute. That's typically been for one, or the most recent one was for 2 years. And that authorization sets a specific amount. And the council is then authorized to impose its tax levy on the basis of what the bonding amount is. So the legislature has effectively set the property tax level by virtue of authorizing the bonds.
Mm-hmm.
In the last few years, the amount that's been set at has been held fairly constant. I think maybe there was a 1% increase in a couple of years ago, something along those lines. I think it's been at sort of held so that the property tax levy amount has not changed appreciably or dramatically in recent years.
Okay, and I think we'll probably want to get more into that aspect in a later meeting as well. So,
yes, Madam Chair, I was hoping to sort of give you a sense of the the concept being out there, and
yep.
Obviously we can dig in further.
Thank you.
And then, Madam Chair and members, I'll touch on some sources and a little bit on the uses of funding. And we've already gotten into some of the background on a couple of these. On the operating side, as well as bus facility replacement, federal, state, farebox recovery, CTIB funding, as well as this regional transit capital levy are all funding streams. For the state, general fund is provided through a direct appropriation that's typically been part of the biennial budget process. And, you know, the Metropolitan Council has usually been within the transportation accounts budget. And then the motor vehicle sales tax is the other component of state dollars. And I had discussed previously the CTIB funding of a portion of the transitway operating costs. So North Star, Commuter Rail, Hiawatha, Central Corridor, green and blue lines, depending on whether you like names or colors. Looking at the 2015 budget that is for the calendar year 2015, following the calendar year budgetary cycle that the Met Council uses, the transportation division breakdown of funds for operating is on this chart. You can see that the motor vehicle sales tax and the general fund are large portions relative to some of the other funding streams. Again, the property tax refers really through to the payment of the debt service on bonds. So it's shown in the operating from the standpoint for the Met Council's budget, but it's a bus facility fleet replacement component. It's kind of more of a capital operating as opposed to new capital projects, kind of fleet maintenance. Looking a bit at the history of state funding, there are a couple of trends and items to highlight in this next chart. First, I'd note that these are biennial amounts, and so the dollars, if you're comparing against some of the other slides, you want to keep in mind that this is not a single year, it's 2 years. One other thing to note, the dollars here are in fiscal year terms, and that's how the state does its budgeting, so you know, July 1 to the subsequent June 30, and the council's budgeting is in calendar year terms. So just as a general thing for the committee to be aware of, both with this presentation and in information that comes the rest of this session, some dollar amounts can be fiscal year and others could be calendar year. And so sometimes things won't seem to tie out, and it has to do with whether it's calendar year or fiscal year basis. This chart is looking at the transit operating over time as far as state funding levels. There are a couple of things that aren't included in here that are kind of more fall on the capital side. One is general obligation bond proceeds that the state issues and pays through the state general fund. Another is that authorization for the regional transit capital levy. And then finally, general fund direct appropriations, general fund cash provided by the state for capital projects. An example of that is the Southwest Corridor that was provided as part of the general fund appropriations to the Met Council. There are a couple other things to highlight with this. The MVES phase-in period, motor vehicle sales tax phase-in, occurred in those middle couple of bars, so 2008 to 2011. 2012 was the first year that MVES was completely phased in. So the growth that you see over that time period is partially a function of the motor vehicle sales tax phasing in, so more state funding via that revenue stream going to transit. At the same time, that was a time of MVES collections being down as a result of, you know, economic factors, and so the overall growth was less than what had been anticipated in previous years. But you can really see the MVES increase in the subsequent biennia from 2012 on. I mentioned earlier in the discussion on CTIB, the legislatively directed funds, and you can see those in the 08-09 as well as in the 12-13 biennia. 08-09, that was the time of CTIB's original authorization. So the original authorizing language included a set dollar amount that CTIB had to first provide to the Metropolitan Council. 2012-2013 was a time of general fund target reduction for in the transportation funding realm, and CTIB legislatively directed CTIB funds effectively backfilled a portion of that reduction in general fund appropriations. And then finally, one other thing to touch on is that the 15, 16, and 17 numbers all rely on the November forecast. So those that's just the latest estimate. We've been discussing the operating side. With respect to capital projects, the funding sources are actually fairly similar, different programs, but kind of similar set of sources. There are a number of different federal programs. For the state, the general fund has been provided general fund direct appropriations for capital, as well as general obligation bonding authorizations. CTIB has been a funding source, as well as the county regional rail authorities and some other local sources, and then finally, again, property taxes, depending on how you kind of count that bus fleet on the operating versus capital side. Finally, again, looking at the Transportation Division budget for the Met Council for 2015, here's a breakdown to give you a sense of where the funding is going. Buses, far and away, the largest category. And for purposes of this chart, that includes the routes that CTIB contracts that operate as Metro Transit but are not actually operated by Metro Transit employees. It also includes the dial-a-ride service outside of the area where the council provides fixed route bus service. So you can see the breakdowns on the light rail transit, that's LRT, commuter rail, metro mobility. Opt-outs account for 5% under this chart, and that is a portion of the motor vehicle sales tax. So I'll talk a little bit about the opt-outs to wrap up. These are the suburban transit providers, and they provide bus service within these opt-out communities, as well as some express bus service, I think to downtown Minneapolis and maybe to downtown St. Paul. I'm not actually sure about that. And that is replacement service instead of the regular route service provided by the Metropolitan Council. Under a statute or a statutory requirement that reflects the 2000, this is a piece, in some ways, this is a piece of the 2001 property tax shift of funding off of property taxes into state funding and using MVES. So under the statute, there's a statutory minimum formula, as well as a formula-based allocation among the opt-out providers. And so the Met Council, following that, provides a portion of the MVES funds to the opt-outs. The council also goes through a second process of allocating some additional funds that are kind of regionally allocated as well from MVES dollars. And just a couple of things that have occurred recently. You saw in a previous chart the 12-13 budgetary pressures, and one of the components of that was the CTIB direction on using funds. Another component was freezing the allocation of MVES dollars and actually reducing it temporarily and shifting some additional MVES revenue to the Met Council. For 2015, the council's budget has 31.8 million headed to the opt-outs. And then finally, on staffing that we had touched on, or Ms. Dyson had touched on that earlier, and distributed something. So, Madam Chair and members, that concludes our overview presentation.
Very good. Mr. Burris, just a quick confirmation, I guess. I had understood that under a statute that exists, that suburban transit providers are not able to deliver passengers from suburb to suburb. Is that correct? They are required to go downtown. I'm looking puzzled.
Madam Chair, I'm not familiar with that requirement. No, I can look that up and get back.
I got it from
that.
A good source, so just wondered what the basis of that is. And very good. Well, are there other questions that folks would have? We will put out the notice tomorrow as to just what we'll be discussing in the meeting next week. We will have a meeting next Thursday in place of GovOps. And for the foreseeable few weeks, I guess, until the GovOps legislative agenda is full of bills, so we will meet for the next few weeks. I appreciate your being here, and thanks very much for the great presentation. It was terrific. Thank you so much, and we are adjourned.